Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready?
Excuse me. Allow me to show you something.
What the Butler Saw with Lee Butler, the podcast.
Look at him, the brats jumping.
You're a legend in the city.
It's my man, Lee Butler.
Wait a second. You're probably thinking, what's going on?
Music, clubland stories, and more.
Fantastic, never heard nobody.
You know it makes sense.
We are privileged to have with us this evening
Lee Butler.
What the Butler Saw with Lee Butler.
You shouldn't excite yourself.
This is it.
The podcast.
And so what?
What the Butler Saw.
Right, how exciting is this? A brand new podcast hosted by my good self. Mr. Lee Butler gives you What the Butler Saw, where I'll be just catching up with people, funky people, groovy people, people with plenty of history, and people who excite me and inspire me, and asking them some great questions and making them spin some bits of music as well. And I'm so excited for the first podcast to be with this guy. He is an absolute legend in the city of Liverpool. He will be a huge soundtrack to many, many people's youth. They will have raved and misbehaved to him. They will have seen him throwing flowers out. They maybe might have even seen him in his white vest at Club 051. It can only be my old partner in crime and my DJ partner, Mr. Dave Graham. How are you, Dave?
What an intro, mate.
Thanks, mate.
What an intro.
All off the top of my head.
Been a while since I've been in here, mate. Fabulous, isn't it?
It is, mate, it is. So, listen, this podcast, and I'm so excited to get you on board for the first one, mate. It's just about us having a gab and maybe being a little bit nosy and asking some of them questions that maybe no one's ever asked you before, and getting an insight into some of the clubland stories and music. Now, let's start at maybe the beginning. Tell me about growing up. You know, I know when I was growing up, and of course, me dad, Billy Butler, I was surrounded by music. I can always remember me dad playing all his old vinyl when he was doing his playlist. Like nowadays, music, when it comes to us, is sent via an email or a mailing list. But back in them days, my dad would be flicking through vinyl to check his playlists out. So I was inspired by being surrounded by music and growing up around it and growing up around radio. But what sort of music were you surrounded by when you were growing up?
It was my sisters, really, Lee, who introduced me to music, because they would. I had a younger sister and an older sister, and I was sort of jammed in the middle. So I would hear their interpretations of what music was. It wasn't a big thing for me at the very, very beginning. You sort of grow with something, don't you? My elder sister was into things like the Jackson 5, the OJs, the Brothers Johnson, Earth, Wind & Fire, Parliament, Stevie Wonder. So there was a very soulful groove in our
house.
Always.
Brothers Johnson and Stomp is one of my favourite records.
Mate.
Disco.
Yeah, phenomenal. The Jackson 5 were probably the most played LP in our house ever.
And me knowing you and knowing your DJ set and knowing musically how your mind works, you can feel that sort of vibe. Your sets are very, they've always been soulful led. I don't mean that in the sound, but I mean that in the emotion.
There's a groove there, and hopefully we'll get to cover some of this later on in our chat, that's what inspired me, because I found that I was listening to stuff, and I think when you're younger, you don't know what you like. You have to be exposed to so many different genres of music, and that was like obviously what my sisters were playing. So that was big for me to hear that kind of music, and it had a big influence on me as well. But at the same time, my mum and dad were listening to the Beatles. They were listening to the Stones. So it's stuff from their generation that I had a big depth with as well. So I could see patterns in music. I could see things that I could pick up and think, I like that. But I didn't know what I actually liked until I started finding more out about music on my own journey by going to the youth club. There was a place by where we lived called the Belmont Road Youth Club. And I didn't know until many, many years after the place was knocked down and gone. But the DJ in there used to be a really big DJ in the clubs in Liverpool. And the music that he would play in there that I would sit and listen to was just a journey. It was just beyond anything you could ever imagine being played in a youth club of that time.
Can you remember his name?
No. I've tried to find out who it was. I see the Belmont Youth Club used to have a disco in there, and it used to, downstairs you have a place where you could do joinery and a place where you could do metal work, and there was a place where you could go and paint. And it was just like one of them places where you'd go after school. But the music there was probably the biggest inspiration, because I would just sit on the step, and the lads never used to dance in them days, Lee. There would just be rows and rows of girls dancing, and I was just, it'd take me away. Listening to what he played was just amazing.
Listen,
I
didn't know what it was. You say all the girls used to get up dancing. Now, it's off the topic slightly, but do you remember when we were growing up and we were young? Let's say we were 17 or 18. Now, lads didn't dance, did they?
No.
Now, and if we wanted to cop off, we had to pluck the courage up. Remember that walk of shame you'd do? You had to pluck the courage up to actually go over and tap a girl to see if they wanted to dance with you.
I remember the walk back more, mate, when they said no.
Mate, listen. I remember we used to go to Quadrant Park in 86. I was only 16, sneaking in there. And Charlie C was playing. And he'd be playing like Curiosity Kill the Cat, Luther Vandross, and stuff like that. And at the end of the night, I would always pluck my courage up and pick a girl that I thought was staring at me all night. She wasn't.
No.
Oh, I'm getting the knock back and walking back to your mates.
The longest walk. I used to say it's like being on a treadmill, because you felt like you were walking, but your friends seemed to get further and further away. And I think in my case, that's exactly what they did. They just thought, here's David. It hasn't happened. Oh, let's leave him.
I used to get in the knock back, mate, when you pluck a kid. It was unfair, mate. You'd be bright red walking
Funny
back to your mates.
When our children say to us, you know, how did you meet each other? Because nowadays, you know, our kids are going to grow up in a world where
they're copping off online now. They haven't got to do anything.
Nothing, mate. You just swipe to the left or the right.
That's
something
fair.
Like that.
We had to pluck the courage up to walk
the
50
art of
yards
conversation
and tap a girl and go, do you want to get up? No.
Art of conversation, mate. It's gone, hasn't it?
Right, okay then. So musically, that I get you, mate. Soulful vibes. When you left school, you grew up in Anfield, didn't you? Am I right?
Yeah.
So, when you left school, what did you want to do and what did you actually do? Because I know when I left school, I didn't know what I wanted to do, really. I grew up in Heighton. We then moved to Crosby. I went to left school, and I went and did a City and Guilds electrical installation course at UBear College. And I got kicked out of that in my last year.
Four.
I can't comment.
Okay.
So, but luckily, I went and got an apprenticeship to be a spark. Now, when I went house bashing and stuff like that, and so that's where I ended up when I left school. So, what did you do?
I think you're right. I think there's a lot of influence on our kids now that with education, we're trying to drive them. You know, try and find something that you're really enthusiastic about. Find something that you love. You'll never do another day's work in your life. All the things that were probably said, but now there's a lot more emphasis on that. When I left school, I just wanted to be a joiner. I just wanted to be a builder. Anything I could do with my hands, coming from a family who were in that kind of industry, that music to me was not ever conceived to be something you could earn money from, to be honest with you. It was just literally about getting onto a building site, hanging doors, hanging windows. And I think it was pretty safe to say at that particular time, there was lots and lots of opportunities on building sites to do that kind of stuff, because Liverpool was pretty hard at the time. You'll remember back in them days, there was loads and loads of unemployment, but building work never seemed to get, it never stopped.
So we're talking sort of in the 80s here, aren't we? When
early.
I left school, it was,
late 70s,
Well, I'm not as old as you, mate. Thanks for that. Don't turn to me with the same brush. I'm talking like 87 when I sort of left school, and I became a spark. And when I was serving my time, I was doing all this sparking around all these building sites and climbing under floorboards. It was around 88, 89. When the sort of acid house scene kicked in, and I got absolutely swept away by it.
That was the first big movement, wasn't it? It wasn't house music. It was acid. But I think that came and went very, very quick.
It did. And I lost my job as a spark due to like the rave and the acid house scene. 89, 90, I was sparking, and then I just went completely off the rails and was following like raves up and down the country. I had because I was doing well, they bought give me a van, and I left my van in Blackburn at a rave. I forgot I'd gone in it. I came home with a party of people to Liverpool and I'd left my van there.
Brilliant.
So that lost me my job there. But, you know, when you left school, you became a joiner. At what point did musically you think, you know what, when did you realise you wanted to be a DJ? And when did you sort of start buying vinyl? How did you get your first set of decks? How did you afford your first set of decks?
If you go back to the first question when you said, you know, when did you realise you want to be a DJ? I don't think back in the days then, a DJ was something that you think, I'd love to do that job. Because a DJ in them days was someone who either did a wedding or a function above a pub, or it was just a guy in the corner.
That's a brilliant point. And all them things you're mentioning, weddings and pubs, I did all them at the start.
Correct, me
when
too.
When I first got me first set of decks, I was 20, I think it was 20. It was 1990. And I started DJing in the Heighton Labour Club, doing like, playing like Jimmy Mack and on 60s music.
Yeah, because those were the celebrations that were happening.
Yeah, yeah.
There wasn't people our age at that time.
No, I was in Council
venues.
Farm.
They weren't doing it. You would play into their mums and dads.
Yeah, I was in
and
the
you
Phoenix,
had to play that music.
A Phoenix, a pub in Canny Farm. And I was there every Saturday night.
It wasn't a career choice.
No, then. It wasn't. You're right.
No,
it was more
wasn't.
Built out of passion.
Correct. It was just we'd been around that music. So it's very easy for us to say, well, I heard my mum and dad play this kind of stuff. So I've got that. I know there's a 7-inch single under the sideboard. So I think just going to these things with families, you get sort of pushed into the corner. Oh, Dave will do the music. So you have to play to your audience at
the
end
of
the day.
So
if I'm doing my nan's 50th birthday or whatever it is, I've got to play music that the rest of the family are going to know that we grew up with. So I would never have made the link. I can make a career out of this.
I'm
going to
ask you a question
that kind of
now
music.
that I didn't think would pop up today, but having just heard what you've said, you mentioned there, you know, you were doing these gigs like I was doing like weddings and functions and playing everything from like Third Finger Left Hand to old Motown to like Come On Eileen. And
anthems of their day.
Yeah, but you would have to look up and play to the floor. And do you think that the fact that you had to do that at an early age had an influence on the fact that you do, you know, lots of people get their head down and play for themselves, don't they?
I know what you're saying, yeah.
Do you think it played a part in that
crowd pleaser?
Crowd pleaser.
Crowd
pleaser. That you became, because
yeah.
I do,
yeah.
I do.
Crowd pleasing, definitely. No one wants to, no one in the career wants to play a track or put a tune on and see the floor empty, because that people vote with the feet.
Of course they do. And we've all got music that we want to play that we take to a gig and you think, I hope I can play this tonight. But you know what, at times that
you don't
you
get
can't
it out of the box
because it won't work.
No, and it's finding the right time. That again to me is something a DJ is renowned for, is programming music and getting it in at the right time, because you can play new stuff throughout these sets that you do, and you can get the most overwhelming response
if it's played
at the right
at
time.
At the right time.
Rather than just
Absolutely.
Putting it on at the beginning of your set and people go, didn't really
this? Or playing three or four of these new tracks.
Should we go to the bar?
Them. Yeah.
So you're right. I think the word crowd pleaser does stem back to the early, early days of making sure your family didn't give you a clip around the ear and go, what
feet.
Are you doing?
Vote with your feet.
Auntie Jean has gone over there for the sandwiches. Get her back on the floor.
Yeah,
you haven't
right.
seen her for years. Get her back.
So how did you get your first set of decks? Can you remember when you got your first set of turntables?
My nan had passed away and she'd left me some money. And I remember there was a shop in St. John's Precinct that used to sell all disco music and lights and decks, smoke machines, mirror balls.
Where
I used
was
to
it?
Go there in St. John's.
I remember that shop.
I can't remember the name. I was trying to think of it before and I can't remember it now. But I used to go there every Saturday. And it used to be, it was probably weird. I got to know the lad who used to work in there. And I used to just stand there. I was mesmerised because they'd have all the lights in the window. And the guy who used to work in there was a DJ and he used to bring music in. So on a Saturday, I'd sort of hang around there, just listening to that kind of stuff that it was playing. But I was mesmerised. But the lights, the music, the smell, everything, when something becomes passionate in your life, has a big effect on your senses, doesn't it? And I remember being there and looking at this equipment and it was called McGregor. They were McGregor decks.
My first set of decks were McGregor decks.
McGregor decks.
I used to look in that window and just, when you call it window shopping now, I used to go into town and just stare at all this amazing equipment. And, I, you know, I was on a YTS doing my apprenticeship as a spark and
it.
I didn't
me
have
too.
Hardly any money.
Yeah, 23 quid a week.
Yeah, and I was looking at this gear and it was just like, and they'd have it all set up in the window, wouldn't they? Used all the disco lights and you'd be looking thinking, I want that.
I used to see how it was and it was so out of my reach. As you said, £23.50 a week, mate, on a youth enterprise allowance scheme. And music, I think a 12-inch single was £1.10 then, which was a lot of money when you're only earning 23 quid
it was,
a week.
Yeah, yeah.
And your mum's getting, you know, £10 out of that. You've got to take your dinner money out, your bus fare money out. You're not left with a great deal of money. But I remember going there and I remember thinking, my nan had left me this money when she passed. And because I was a joiner at the time, I thought I could make a box. That's easy. I could go to PRS on Dale Street and buy two decks. And I could go to another place called Tandy.
Yeah. And I
bought a two-slide mixer. And I put it all together. And it looked like when I was going out to do gigs, I was carrying a coffin up the stairs. It was so big and so well made. It was a fabulous piece of machinery. But that's how I got my first set of decks, because I couldn't afford them. I think a set of McGregor decks in them days were about £400. And 23 quid a week.
No.
It just wasn't happening. So I saved up to buy the decks.
Yeah,
I saved
up to buy the mixer. My uncle actually had a set of, you know, the decks that came in the flight case. So they were like, they were the first ones I managed to work on that had like a pitch adjuster on where you could actually mix.
It was not, you used to mix. Use your thumb.
Yeah, but no. You could actually mix on these. They had a little weenie plastic slider on the side, and it was like a combined unit with the mixer in the middle. And I used to practice on that in his house. And they were my very, very first set of decks. I didn't own them, but I got a chance to play on them. So how did that lead onto your first gig?
I was a glass collector. As we said before, the money wasn't particularly brilliant in the jobs that we were doing from being a joiner and working on the enterprise allowance schemes. So I would go out and collect glasses, and I used to go work in a club on Duke Street called Hollywood. And there's an amazing DJ there, again, another big influence, called Roscoe Travis. Everyone knows Roscoe. And he used to play these amazing tracks like the Fat Back Band. And I'd be collecting glasses.
I Found Loving. Oh, I Found Loving.
Exactly.
Since I found you.
You got a better voice
than
me.
I'm in love with you. Oh, what a tune.
So that became another catalyst in, could I be a DJ? Because I'd look at him and think, God, he's just got this amazing collection of music. But that was where it started to happen, because I'd be earning money in the day doing the joinery, then I'd go glass collecting at night, and I had more money to spend on music. So therefore, I was starting to get and collect a better record collection.
Were you like me when you got the bug and you finally went, you know what, I love doing this, I want to play to people, and you're finding your own style by that time. You then get to a point where every bit of money you've got left was spent on buying music. Mine was. It was a fantastic era of buying vinyl, which is lost now, which unfortunately. But going to whether it was 3Beat or Hot Wax or any of these places and buying vinyl with your money or whether it was HMV.
Finding it, for me, was the biggest buzz.
Oh, it was amazing.
Finding something in the
but
racks.
But every penny. Because by that time, sort of when you're getting into the 90s now and you're buying records that you want to go out and play at your sets, you know, they were five or six quid.
Imports.
Yeah, they were coming from Italy or, you know, the USA, whether it be Strictly Rhythm or...
They were very, very expensive. Because
every penny I had went on buying music. I wasn't DJing anywhere at the time. I did have my decks then. I'd just be DJing in my bedroom.
Yeah.
But everything you had was like, I've got another 7 quid. I'm going to go to town.
Yeah. I've walked to town today, mate, and walked back just to get a
record.
To
get music.
Honestly.
Yeah.
And I think that stems back to the passion about why we became DJs. I think you become a DJ out of default, because all of a sudden you've got this amazing collection of records and someone goes, it's Jimmy's 18th.
I think back then it was that way. I think now there's that many superstar DJs that it is, if youngsters will look up to your...
They'll never do it the way we do it, because
that was organic.
Nothing happens.
It was organic.
Correct.
But
they shouldn't.
No. But I think with the huge rise of all these like DJs and pop stars now, the worldwide megastars, So,
could you ever imagine, though, Lee, saying to your dad, I'm going to be a megastar DJ? Because you'd have looked at you and go, hang on, son, that's me. Because that was what your dad did.
Yeah, yeah.
That was what a DJ was. He was a radio DJ. He was a personality DJ.
Yeah, he spoke on the
sudden,
mic.
A DJ is telling a story through his choice of music and not through his personality.
You're right. Brilliantly put. So, we land at the first sort of major venue that people will relate to Dave Graham for?
Well, I don't know. I think we better take away the word major, maybe, because it was anything but major, and I should be really careful here what I do say about this place, because it's still open, but not under the genre it was when I was DJing. It's called a Pen and Wig, and it was a real difficult place. I remember when I joined them, the licensee Her name was Debbie. I won't say any more names in case she's listening to this. And she said to me, we want to change the music policy in here because there's been too many fights. So, of course, you know, that sort of makes you think this is probably not the right kind of place. So I said, what's the DJ in here now playing? And he was playing things like Pink Floyd, Genesis, Peter Gabriel. And she said, you know, when he plays certain records, you know, a table will get thrown or a pint will get thrown over so on. And it's like the OK Corral.
Sounds great.
So, yeah, I thought, you know what? What have I got to lose? I'm going to roll up here with me Michael Jackson.
What was this venue called?
Pen and Wig.
The Pen and Wig.
Yeah, I think it's a lap dancing
lots
bar.
Of people, lots of people will never have known the fact that you DJed the Pen and Wig first.
I was there for about a year and a half, and it went from this place where it was more like spit and sawdust, and, you know, whoever had the best right hook, had the best night out.
So what were you playing in there?
Oh, it was great, because it went from, you know, as you said, Pink Floyd, Genesis, Peter Gabriel, to things like the Jacksons, George Clinton. So you can imagine these men come from various parts of town. They may have been out with the mates on a stag night, been the football, just rolled around town, had a belly full of beer, and then they're ready for a good fight. And then this little guy from Breck Road turns up with the Jackson 5. I didn't go down well, mate, to say. They used to have three doormen on when I first joined. And when I left, there was three doormen. But the bit in the middle, they were up to 12 doormen.
Oh, dear.
God, does so that tell you?
You've got all these beefy doormen on there, and you've got that you looking like you're the head doorman on the on the Mothercare. The head doorman on Mothercare.
It just wasn't happening because I just get so many threats. If you carry on playing this music, mate, you're going to get this, you're going to get that. So at the end of every night, there was more doormen in front of the DJ. But do you know what? I've got to give a huge amount of respect to Debbie, who was the licensee at the time, that she said, it's brilliant. What you're doing is brilliant. There is more and more girls coming and more girls staying. And every week that goes by, there's less and less trouble. There's less and less. We just, you know, unfortunately, if your records get broke, and they did, and the decks went over, and speakers got drunk.
When I used to play at the Phoenix in Cancel Farm, let me tell you, some of the barnies that used to go on in there, and it was quite scary. I'd be playing, like, Gary Puckett and the Union Girl. I'd be playing Young Girl or a big 60s Motown anthem. I'd look up, and there'd be tables and carnage there in Canny Farm. But, you know, it's, I suppose,
got to start somewhere.
You have.
You've got to start. And I don't think there's a DJ on this planet who hasn't got a story like that. Who'll go, my first gig was. And I think they're the memories, mate. They're priceless.
Of course they are. So I'm gonna take everybody to probably the first venue that you played that people will relate to you for. And this place is called The Drome.
The Drome, yeah.
Now, Birkenhead, a unique place and a style of music that was a lot harder and bouncy.
Yeah, it was.
And at what point did you go from playing the Jacksons to playing Joey Inferno?
Yeah. I used to go to London a huge amount of times in the week because obviously in them days, there was so much time on our hands. We had loads and loads of things. So I used to just jump on the train, go down to London for 3 or 4 days, and I'd go round record shops and I'd see what was happening. And of course, London being the capital, everything would happen in this country there before it happened anywhere else. And what I wanted to do was try and leapfrog Birmingham, Manchester, and come back here. So if I went out down there and seen music that was being played, I was trying to bring it back here and do the same kind of thing. The only other club at the time that was doing that kind of thing was Quadrant Park, which was, again, another Sharon and Tracy club that the four lads took over and said, you know what, this house, dance, the end of the acid rave thing.
See, lots of people, when they hear the name Quadrant Park, automatically think of 1990-91 and those incredible, unforgettable nights.
I would, very short
period,
though.
I would not swap my Saturday nights there for anything else. They were just, unless you were there,
yeah,
they were incredible,
organic,
priceless nights, yeah, there with John Kelly and Mike Nolan. Andy.
And the catalyst, with all honesty, to the Liverpool music scene.
Absolutely. But there was a scene before that at Quadrant Park, which you're probably maybe talking to. It was a Shannon and Tracy club.
Correct. It was where you used to go. If it was your 18th, they would do these things called mail shots years ago. And if they had your date of birth and your postcode, they knew from the electoral roll when it was your baby.
I used to go to the Quadsden Park when I was 17, 1987, 88. And it was a Shannon and Tracy club. It was a good one and it was full.
Correct.
It was full. Charlie C used
show.
To be on there.
It was all about the light show, wasn't it?
It was brilliant,
all about
it?
The light shows.
But lots of people forget that. So the drone came about, and can you remember starting at the drone?
I remember it was a fun pub for a while.
It was.
And that was the big thing of the time. You'd go to these places and the DJ would insult you. And it's just a period when music just wasn't that predominant to what we know it. And I remember going in, speaking to the owner, Eric, at the time, and saying to him, do you know what, you need to stop this because there's a big dance thing going to come along. And of course, like every owner, a great respect for Eric, he said, it's all drug related. You know, I don't want to be a part of
the
it.
Thing
I don't
is,
want
the whole rave scene and the word rave, even nowadays, is automatically anybody who doesn't know about the scene fully will automatically, their first response is rave equals drugs.
Correct.
Which is untrue.
And also,
of course,
the time,
it was a massive part
always on the TV.
Of the breakthrough rave scene in 89, 1981 at Quadsden Park and all these places, Shelley's in Stoke, Hacienda Manchester,
Pimp,
all these golden, all these amazing breakthrough places, you know. I'd be lying if I didn't say drug culture was a huge part of it. Of course it was. Ecstasy was a massive part of it and everything else. I'd be lying to say that, but...
So you could understand their perception.
Yeah.
They don't want the association.
Absolutely.
And I said to him at the time, if you don't get on board here, you're going to get left behind. And he said, I'd sooner leave it. Anyway, because a long story short, I left the club and I went to work at a little club around the corner called Atmosphere.
Atmosphere and Birkenhead. Remember that?
Now, they always had a massive Friday night and a massive Saturday night. And I remember going into the guy and saying, can you open up on a Thursday? I've got this idea. And he said, there'll only be me, you and the Glass Collectors. And I said, well, that's great. At least five of you will be dancing. And I never forget saying that. Thursday night became bigger than both the Friday and the Saturday put together. And then Eric said to me, come back and we'll have a chat. And I did. I went back, we sat down, and the drone became what it was. And it was unbelievably black and white to where it had come from, this fun pub days, back into the right now of what was happening at that particular time in London.
What year would you say we're in now?
I say we're in 1990.
1990? Okay, so lots of people, when they think of the drone, think of yourself. Trixie was there after you, wasn't he?
He came when I left. Trixie came to the drone when I went over to the 051. The DJs who were at the drone at the time was Dave Simpson, Rusty came over with me, and God bless his soul, Philly.
It was. Lots of people don't realise is lots of people maybe who aren't really overly clued up on a lot of the history of the drone was, lots of people will look at it and go, it was that mad place that played bouncy music and drum and bass and this big
It was hard edge. There was a big... Well, you look at the DJs that we booked.
But this is where I'm headed now. What people don't realise is there was some absolutely groundbreaking DJs played at the drone.
Correct.
Of course, the biggest one of all.
Carl Cox.
Carl Cox played there, didn't he?
Well, I'd seen Carl Cox play in London and I remember thinking, my God, he's amazing. He's just... He was just having the best night out. It was like watching him. He was having his night out and we were just there to be with him. And I thought, I've got to get his number. So I did. I got his number. But also, we booked other DJs like Rat Pack were amazing. They played all over the country. They played in the drone. Fabio and Groove Rider,
Huge names.
They got booked to play there. The best thing for me, and even the lads from Quadsden Park, when the quad closed, I spoke to all the lads. The only one who didn't come and play was James Barton. I think at the time he was ready to start his club.
His cream.
Yeah.
Brand. And he actually went from Quadsden Park to Club 051.
That's right.
He did.
Yeah. There'll be loads of this that people will go, wow.
I never knew that. Yeah, so
I didn't know. Yeah. But John
lots of people think James went and started Cream after the Quadsden Park, but he didn't. No. He was at the 051 with
someone Smith.
John Smith. They did loads of huge nights. I mean, Roger Sanchez, Sasha, all the huge names, Morales, all were at the 05.
Huge respect for James, mate, because out of everything that's happened in this city, he is the club and empresario, as far as I'm concerned, because he came right the way through from being the DJ to having one of the biggest brands
in the world,
globally.
In the world, so, in the world.
If I had my hat on, I'd be tipping it.
You would do, mate. Absolutely, absolutely. So the Drome went on for quite a few years, didn't it?
Yeah, I worked there for about a year and a half, and it was amazing. And it was harder. It was definitely...
faster.
Yeah, it was right off the back, as you said, the acid house scene. And I'll never forget some of the memories of the Drome. Hazy, as you can imagine. But the biggest thing for me was, and I still always find this really surprising, people queuing up at 6 o'clock to get into clubs on a Saturday night.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And there's videos out there online, on YouTube, showing you that queue around the block. And the Drome held 2,000 people. And you would see the best part of nearly 3,000 people queuing up. Not everyone got in.
But I think that whole, like, tingling in your belly that you'd start getting on a Thursday or Friday, it was all based around those huge nightclubs. Yeah. It obviously starting with the Drome, because you were locking out by half an hour of opening, huge queues, early doors. I know the Quads and Park, I mean, Saturday night for me was just like, it was everything, and not getting in would have been the worst thing. So we'd be outside the Quads and Park at 7:30.
I still think
the doors opened at 9 o'clock. We'd be standing waiting outside the Quad at 9 o'clock.
Yeah.
And at 7 o'clock. And in the 051, when we went the 051, the State was the same. Yeah. We were doing them nights at the State. You couldn't get in the State after midnight. The doors were locked. The 051 and the queues at Club 051 when we were there were just insane.
Do you not think that adds to the atmosphere?
Absolutely.
I think that's amazing. When you got, because I've been one of them customers. It, all over the country, and when you go to Ibiza, that anticipation of how the night's going to be, and you're discussing it, and you can hear other people in the crowd and other people in the queue, and you're meeting people that you haven't seen for ages. And then them days, you would have friends who lived all over the country because you would meet them at these events.
And wasn't it mad, Dave, though? You know, like nowadays, all these big events are ticket-led events. There was no, you couldn't pre-book your ticket for the Quad. Weekly. No. You just had to go and queue up.
And go online now, and even can't you? And book a table. Yeah, and tell them what beer you want on the table.
Everything's done. You look how much it's changed from 1990 when I'd be getting ready at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd be heading to the Quad at 6 or 7 o'clock. And your case in 1990, the Drome, and all these people will be coming and queuing up outside. Nowadays, you can actually plan your whole night out
online.
You can book your table, you can book your entrance, you can book your drinks, you can
your
book
date.
Your taxi home, you can book your date. You know, like, it does feel like the spur of the moment excitement has gone.
It's
has
almost,
gone.
It's pre-planned, isn't it? Everything now is organised to within an
eighth. There's not a chance now that you won't get in unless you're dressed wrong.
Yeah.
But back then, there was a chance you'd get locked out because you couldn't pre-book. It was a case of that excitement. And can you imagine the amazing buzz when you got in, just getting in itself.
One of the biggest nights in the Drome was the night we booked the Prodigy. And they went to number one on Top of the Pops that week. And we had them on that Saturday. And that is probably, for me, the most
standout moment
in my career.
Yeah. I can remember going to see Enjoy perform in 1991 at the Quads and Park, and the lead singer was called Saffron, and she was lovely, and I was only 20 then, she was probably 20, and I was just remember she was crying singing Enjoy's anthem to the Quad. It was one of the Quads and Park's biggest tunes, and I'll never forget that moment ever.
These are iconic times that we were part of, and it's a great honour to have these stories, isn't it, and to have these memories that we've had. But I'll never forget the whole band, the Prodigy, arrived about an hour and a half before Keith did, and when he turned up about 10 minutes before, he you could just tell that this fellow was just, he was going to be a superstar. You could just tell he was not rude, he was not big-headed, he had just an amazing aura around him. He was very, very calm. But the minute we introduced him and he came on stage, it was like someone had just let off a box of fireworks in your back kitchen. And I've never seen an atmosphere like that. And of course, I've seen him in concerts since then. And you just think, it just takes you back. He's never lost that essence of what it is to be a performer. And of course, The Prodigy, when they did that track, Charlie Says, it was, I know now, because it became a chart hit and it became overplayed and... But
that shouldn't reflect on the original track. Lots of people now, or and it happens with lots of tracks now, where something is organically grown out of the clubs, and then it crosses over. And when it crosses over, people go, "I don't like that no more."
Yeah, gets dropped.
You know, Enjoy Anthem was a huge chart smash in the end.
Yeah,
but originally it was one of the biggest songs in the Quadsden Park. Now that leads me perfectly on. So we finish off and we'll wrap up the drone by me asking you to play me one track that just reminds you of the drone.
It's got to be, it has to be The Prodigy, and it's got to be Charlie. There's nothing else. I could say Joey Beltram, I could say Moby Go, all equally. But for that moment, for those people, I mean, that was a night. There was probably just under 3,000 people in there that night. So if we...
They've lost the license anyway now.
It's been knocked down.
It's been knocked down, yeah. There was 1,000 over capacity.
It was just another level.
And here it is for you. Go on, introduce her.
The Prodigy. For those who can remember when we had them at the drum.
Charlie says always tell your mummy before you go off somewhere.
It is What the Butler Saw, the podcast. Lee Butler here, and so excited to be launching these podcasts. You can catch them, of course, on my brand new website, leebutler.co.uk. You can subscribe on iTunes to my new podcast as well, and that way you will get the first information as soon as it comes out in your face, in the place. So make sure you get a little nose, What the Butler Saw, and it is, of course, every single time on my website, leebutler.co.uk. Right, catching up with Dave Graham, just played you The Prodigy and Charlie Says, summing up his time at the drone. And we move on now, Dave. Are you ready to move on with me?
Got to go to the 051.
Yeah, so you leave the drone and you come to Club 051. And of course, that is a big musical change.
Yeah.
Is that the reason why you wanted to go from the drone?
Yeah. It was because, again, and I've got to go back to where I was getting all my influences from, I'd go down to London, and that kind of music and audience was changing rapidly. It was no longer cool to be getting your tops off. It was no longer cool to be dancing around in your hoodie t-shirts in the middle of a field. The music had made a seismic shift, and I could tell that. The year before, of course, Cream had opened up, and I could see people like James and Darren, they were booking the kind of DJs, and they were completely different from what was going on 3 or 4 years ago. So I knew I was on the right track. Here were the two lads who'd set up Cream. They changed direction. I could see what was going on in London. So for me, it was a natural progression to, and it's also good to stop when you're doing something really, really well, and to go in another journey and take people with you.
It's a fresh challenge, isn't it?
Music,
it's a fresh challenge.
Well, music's organic, isn't it, Lee? You can't keep doing the same thing, because people will go, "I've had that jam on toast every time I see you." You've got to keep it changed. You've got to keep it fresh. So for me, it was a good thing, because musically for me, I had to really up my game.
Do you think you'd grown up a little bit more?
Yeah.
Musically.
Yeah,
musically,
I do,
because
yeah,
when you were in the drone, it was like 150 BPM.
It was a huge
difference to what you went to the 051 with. You're talking about going from Joey Beltram, as you say, or Joey Inferno with Tribal Church, or
To Judy Cheeks. Which was gospel almost.
It's a gospel house.
Hands in the air.
So it's a massive shift musically, and it's more musically what a lot of the people listening to this podcast will know you for.
Yeah.
It is this soulful, uplifting, emotional music that Dave Graham gives you, the performer, the guy that throws flowers to the crowd, the guy that holds these you know, plaques up with all these statements on. The guy who's, as you said, is on a night out with the crowd. Yeah. And do you think that when you got to the 051, how did that come about? When did the link with Club 051 start?
Good friend of mine called Mike said to me, "I want to introduce you to these two guys. They're going to open up the 051 and they want to have a chat with you." And this was on the night about 2 weeks before and we had Carl Cox. And I remember that the Saturday that Carl Cox had played, on the Monday morning, I was coming over to Liverpool to see the two owners. And they said to me, look, we're going to open this club. Do you want to be part of it? And I thought to myself, on paper, I've just left a club with 2,500 people in on Saturday night, played with who I believed was going to be one of the biggest superstars in the world, Carl Cox.
And is. Let's get it right.
Coxie!
What am I?
What a guy. What am I going to bring to the table for this nightclub that's been closed down by the police because of trouble? What can I bring? You've got Cream just opened up down the road. They've got all the DJs contracted to them. Really, that did me a massive favour because I had to really up my game musically then, because I couldn't play what I just brought from the drone. I had to do this new music and I had to play something that I felt that was spiritually right for me to play.
Let me put a time span on this now. So I like it when we were talking and I can gradually build us through. So we've been in the drone 1990, 1991.
Yeah, so you were up to 92, 93
I'd say
now.
You're probably in 1993 now. Yeah. And the reason I think of that link is because mine and your musical journeys always, until 1996, we never joined forces. We were always apart.
Knew each other, though.
Of course we did. But in 1993, I just started the State.
Yeah.
So the State, of course, had loads of amazing history. And it was there that I sort of built my name and started building my name. But at that point, you were just starting out at Club 051. What a venue, Dave.
We were playing Alison Limerick. Again, big vocal house, Kate Klass, Judy Cheeks, Mariah Carey. You couldn't have been further down the musical spectrum from playing Moby Go.
No, you're right. And whilst you were playing them, and I think this is why our sort of genres, they crossed slightly. I was playing probably more the Italian stuff,
yep.
More the big pianos and the screaming vocals,
yep.
And the Ginny Keep Warms and the JK Beat It, whereas you were playing more of the Alison Limericks and the Judy Cheeks, yep. and the Coming Out Crew and Free Gay and Happy and all this like really big soulful uplifting stuff, whereas the State was more full on.
Well, we had to
scream and rave.
We had to create our own identity for the club because no DJ wants to copy the DJ down the road. No club wants to copy the club down the road. We had to make our own statements. And if you haven't got the availability to book some of these big name DJs, you're relying on your musical.
One thing I've always loved about being a DJ, and one thing I always wanted to have when I started out passionately and realised, you know what, I'm going to end up playing the clubs. What I always like to have, and you've got this, Dave, is the ability that if someone walks into the club when Dave Graham's playing, blindfolded,
They know
you're on.
Yeah.
And I'd like to think I've got that ability.
Yeah.
You've got that unique style of your own or them unique anthems that you've
brought. I've been very lucky, Lee.
But you have got, if you're DJing, I could walk into a nightclub blindfolded and know that's Dave Graham. Yeah. And that's...
I think that's important to how the club became musically identified, because no one, as we said at that particular time, was playing that more gospel kind of vocal.
Cream were more underground, weren't they, at that point?
Yeah.
They were booking people like Fabi Paris. He did the opening night of Cream. I went to that, which was just in the back room.
Yep.
And then they were booking huge DJs from all over the world. I mean, how difficult was that to compete with them? And we'll get onto this when we come to sort of when I joined you at Club 051. But what I thought with the state was Liverpool, it screamed Scousers. You know, there's not many people coming from out of town to go to the State. It was Liverpool.
Yeah.
You had your own speck in the State.
Yeah.
Breck Road and the North Enders had their own space. The South Enders had their area. And there was times when they'd clash and there was a little bit of hoo-ha going on in there. But the 051 probably had a bit more of a travelling crowd come there, but not as much as to compete with...
Cream were coming from one end of the country to the other.
Of course
we were very northwest based. I think we would get people coming up from Bolton, we'd
Chester.
Get them coming from Manchester, Chester, North Wales. So we were very northwest based. But I think the prominent thing for me, what made the club, it was aimed at a very vocal audience. It was aimed predominantly at being a place where girls wouldn't get hassled by lads jumping around in hoodie tops. And it was just, if they wanted to put their fake handbag down and hot foot it around it for the whole night, that was where they were going to go, because no one else was playing that music. So that's how it got its identity, I think. And it held that identity for a really, really long time, until a point, and you probably won't remember how we got together and how you came over to the O5. And you'll remember, obviously, the opening night when we did.
Of course. Thing. Now, let me stop you there. So we're probably in the year of 19. Before I've come to Club 051, I'm at the State. It's 1994, maybe early 95.
Yeah.
You've got your nights with Cy Edwards and Rusty, and you've got your Hell's Party of a Friday night. So I'm now going to stop and ask you to pick me a track and play me an anthem that you think absolutely stinks of that era, 94-95, at Club 051.
It's got to be one of the very, very big anthems that we played at the time, and it was Judy Cheeks' Reach.
Absolute tune.
It's my man, Lee Butler.
You're a legend in the city.
What the Butler Saw with Lee Butler, the podcast. Music, clubland stories and more.
This is it.
The podcast.
And so what?
What the Butler Saw with Lee Butler.
You shouldn't excite yourself.
It is Lee Butler, the podcast. You can find this on my website, leebutler.co.uk. It's on iTunes. You can subscribe as well. What the Butler Saw, me catching up and having a good old chinwag with gossip, scandal and clubland jangle with all the big jocks. And whoever I fancy having a talk to, make sure you get part of it. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes. What the Butler Saw, Lee Butler, the podcast. I'm catching up with Dave Graham. We've just played you the incredible Judy Cheeks and Reach, which basically sums up Dave Graham's era at Club 051, sort of around 94, 95. And at that point, in 1994, I was at the State. But I left the State, Dave, in 1994. And I'd had an amazing time there. It was so difficult for me to leave. But at that point, we were filling it every single Saturday night. It was chocker. Fridays and Saturdays was amazing. It was me, Mark Simon, and Steve McGee had just joined us at that point. Davey T had just left. And it was full. But I wasn't on Brilliant Money there. Now, I love the owners, Alan and Cliffy. You know Alan and Cliffy, they had the drone. Two great guys, two characters, right?
Both driving nicer cars than us.
Absolutely. But I think I was on 75 quid a night at the State at that point. And it was full. And I could feel I was starting to create my own style and my own following.
I'm following
as well. And I then get an offer from the Buzz Club and Ian Kane, right, to go to the Buzz. And he offered me double money. He offered me 150 quid a night to leave to go to the Buzz. And it was one of the toughest decisions I've made. But I went the Buzz Club in 1994 in about the start of 95, maybe. My memory's not great there, sort of in that era, as you can imagine. But I went the Buzz and I was only at the Buzz for 12 months. And lots of people ask me what my thoughts are about the Buzz Club. I was never a massive fan of the Buzz. I liked it. Mm. I liked it. And there were some brilliant nights there. John Cotton was there before me. There were some huge nights there. But the Buzz Club, having left the State, which was really like an old ballroom, really clubby.
Yeah.
I went the Buzz.
Special look, Buzz. When you think back at the States, I can remember it before you were there, when Steve Proctor used to be a DJ,
Mike Nola.
In that time, they were playing all them big tunes from the New Wave.
New Order, The Smiths.
U2, Big Country.
Absolutely. It was the new romantic era.
It was phenomenal. It was phenomenal.
And the Stapes steep with history. You know, yeah. Dead or Alive shot the video. Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Yeah.
Letter to Brezhnev was shot in there. So leaving there was tough for me.
China Crisis.
Yep, was tough for me. But I went to Buzz, and I was at the Buzz for 12 months. And I had some brilliant nights at the Buzz Club, but the Buzz Club for me felt like a little bit slightly Shannon and Tracy.
Yeah.
It was carpeted, which was
nice. It was nice, wasn't it?
It was more plush. Nice, yeah. It was more plush. And so for that reason, it felt like slightly less industrial, and I wanted something a bit more clubby. And I was only at the Buzz 12 months, and that was 95. a bit longer, 95 right the way through into 1996, and it was probably around April or May of 1996 that the big decision came for me and you to join forces.
We talked for a long time, hadn't we, before then, because we'd known each other, having Groover Records in Matthew Street. I knew you from coming in. I knew where you'd played. I knew who you were. You obviously, we had a very good mutual admiration for each other because we were both filling.
We were,
major clubs.
But if we're brutally honest about major it, our clubs. Musical styles were quite different.
Completely.
I was a lot bouncier than you, maybe a little bit cheesier than you at the time. You know, you were a little bit cooler with your music. You know, you could compare your Alison Limericks to maybe your Strike, you sure do, your JK
right.
Beat
I see what you're saying.
JK
see what
Beat
saying.
It to your Royal Tees coming back for more. But there was...
then again, you could say on the other side of that coin, if you were playing what I was playing, that wouldn't have worked.
It wouldn't
if I
have
was
worked.
Playing what the lads in Cream were playing, it wouldn't have worked.
No,
so what
was,
you're
listen,
saying is
was,
you carved out.
Of course. Yeah, of sound. Course. So I was playing lots of acapellas. I was being really creative. I got lots of inspiration from John Kelly with his acapellas. So I was cutting stuff up. I was doing things slightly differently. There was lots of these acapellas getting played and I was rooting out really signature tunes, whether it was Swankenstein, Music Lover or...
This is why Liverpool, mate, took off in such a big way, because there was a diversity in music policies in Liverpool, which you probably didn't get
now,
in Manchester.
No, you're
everyone
right.
in Manchester
we
wanted to be the Hacienda.
We were spoiled.
Everyone
Liverpool
in Manchester wanted to be the Hacienda.
Spoiled. We've had the from the Grafton, from the Cavern to the Grafton, to the She Club, to the Paradox, whether you label them, whether you're a music snob, and I'm not into people who
the history of clubs in Liverpool
no,
is
but
phenomenal.
What I don't like about, and I'm not a big fan of, is people who... if that scene isn't their style, who diss it?
Yeah.
If you love bouncy hardcore and you went to Drome, brilliant.
Yeah.
I meant I like that type of music, but you know what? Fantastic.
Yeah.
Go and enjoy it. The Paradox was cheesy, but you know what? Loads of people loved it,
correct.
Dave. Yeah. The State was different than the 051. The Cream was at that point different from then. You had the Barcelona Bar, the Aquarium, the Garage.
Doesn't that make it...
Fallows in Speak, Fallows in Entry.
That makes a great fabric, doesn't it?
How amazing was Liverpool's club scene back then?
Phenomenal.
It was spoiled rotten.
Yeah, phenomenal. There was more people. I remember speaking to James Barton once, and he said he just found out that there was more people wanted to come to Liverpool unis because of the nightclub scene, probably predominantly...
I mean, no one will ever be Cream and what it creates. It is absolutely phenomenal what it creates. But obviously James Barton, take him a little bit before the Quads and Park, and him and John Kelly had an amazing night at the Underground, which was on Victoria Street in Liverpool. And they had people like Adamski played there live.
Yeah.
You know, so huge credit to them guys. They were the real, for me, sort of icons of Liverpool, is your John Kellys and your Jameses. And these people were there in 88, 89 when the whole thing was bubbling away. But we're back now in 1996. And let me tell you the short memories that I've got of how I came about to go to Club 051. Because as you can imagine, there's no escaping the fact that I was off the rails in the 90s, mate. I was in some terrible states. I was partying hard. And, you know, my memory isn't brilliant of the 90s. But I can remember I lived in a flat in Bold Street, above what is now Smithies.
Yeah.
Right. It used to be Sayers then. Right. And I had the top flat. Now, anyone walking up and down Bold Street on a Sunday morning about 8 a.m. may have seen me out the window with music blasting.
Party never
continuing
ended.
Continuing the party.
Party
but
never ended.
I got a knock on my door by the two Johns, John Lynch and John Cuomo. And I walked out my door and they were standing there and they said, Lee, it's John Lynch and John Cuomo. We've got Club 051. And I went, oh, yeah. He said, well, I'll take you for a cup of coffee. And they took me to Maggie May's, which is still there.
Do you remember that?
Yeah, yeah.
Fried breakfast.
Maggie May's. And that was the first time I'd ever been offered to be part of creating a new night. I had nights at the State, Monster Jam and some of these nights we did, but I was never on a deal where I was part of the success of the night.
And I think that's what you wanted at that time. I think that's what you were missing. I don't think it was the clubs, because the clubs you were playing were obviously very, very busy and they would do it. Your following was there. I think what you wanted is more creative.
Absolutely. And at the State, I did get the ability to be creative with our amazing Monster Jam nights and some incredible nights, and we had loads of amazing acts. Farley, Jackmaster Funk and play came there. We had KWS when they were number one with Please Don't Go on a Thursday night that was locked out. We had Hyper Go Go and all that type of stuff. Everyone came there. But I was never involved in a deal where I felt like I could go forward. And at the when John and John came and said to me, we want you to be part of a brand new Saturday night that's coming to Liverpool, and we want you to come and have a chat with Dave. And that is the first memory I've got of it. Now, I don't know what was going on at the 051 at that point, where they came to you and went, look, should we progress to something else? I don't know how my name came about to you.
Well,
about...
it was the other way around, because I said to them, look, there's a chance here if we can get Lee on board with what we're doing. Whatever we're doing now, you'll get a Friday night, you'll get a Saturday night. And at the time, they were looking to open another club upstairs called The Sunrise.
They were, yeah.
And I said, if you're going to do that, you can't dilute the audience you've got. You have to bring in another audience to top up if you're going to fill all of these things. Anyway, the Friday didn't happen. They actually opened up upstairs, became The Sunrise. And that was the very beginning. And they were like, well, how's it going to work musically? And that was always the big thing, as you said earlier on. Musically, we were different.
We were different, but there was lots of tracks that crossed over. You know, yeah. Like you'd be playing Glam Hell's Party, so would we. You know, you'd be playing Happy Clappers, I believe. Subliminal Cups. Yeah. There was lots of the biggies.
That's why I thought it would work, and it did. Oh. Because I think what we forget, not just from a musical point of view, whether these two musical influences would bind, I think what we both had was atmospheres.
Yeah,
and you know, I think that was the key. If we could bring that atmosphere and that atmosphere, we'd have an explosion.
Yeah,
and I think that worked, because musically I did change my pattern, and I think musically you changed yours, and we ended up with a sound from that 96 period to probably 99 that was predominantly 051 and no one else.
Of course, that was
your Derudes, your Sandstorm. It became a lot more tougher and a lot more harder, didn't it?
It did, and 96 to 99, maybe 2000, when it was Sexy Medicine, were just some of the most incredible, incredible, incredible times at Club 051. What standout memories do you have of our time together? Now, one for me, and I have no idea what you're going to say, but for me, when I left The Buzz in 96, it was early 96, I had a couple of months off. I had to go and tell The Buzz that I was leaving, and that's a different story. And at some point on the podcast, I will tell you about that heavy, heavy story. They had some big doorman there, mate, and I had to go and break the news, and it was tough, very tough indeed. But when I finally got free from The Buzz, I had a couple of months off when we built this campaign, and what was so exciting was me and you joining forces and getting the ability to get creative. And
do you remember we'd meet in these cafes?
Oh, yeah. And your creation was, as people know who are listening, know Dave Graham well, and have come to see Dave Graham at his gigs over the years. He's a performer, and that reflects in his creation and his nights. And what we and you wanted to create was a show.
Yeah,
didn't we? We wanted to create a show. And it was October 1996 when we launched our first night. We went to do a deal with Radio City, where we would be the first club ever to broadcast live at midnight right across the airwaves of Liverpool in the Northwest, which was daunting in itself.
It was.
But the opening night, Battle of the Heavyweights.
But it was clever what we did in 96. We wanted to open. We could tell the musical genre was becoming more and more commercial. Ibiza was going off the scale. More and more people were getting into dance music. So my idea when I spoke to the Johns was, we can get hold of Lee and we can get hold of Pez and we can hit a live broadcast, bring Lee over with his musical following that he's got, what we've already got here. You've got another 5 years in the bag. And clubs have to constantly keep reinventing themselves, whether it's with the DJs, whether it's with a shop fit where you have to go out and make the seats nicer and the lights show brighter, or the DJs. You have to constantly keep reinventing, and that was my job at the 051. Getting Pez on board was a killer stroke, because we were then not just broadcasting to the people in the club who we were playing to every week, but Lee Butler then was being heard from one end of Blackpool.
It was,
and
it was the first, that was probably the start of my journey through onto radio. But what always blew me away about my most memorable night at 051's probably the opening night. One, yeah. because the nerves when we were DJing live.
Yeah, it was tough, I mean, that, wasn't it?
You know, you were on decks then. We were on vinyl on 1210s Technics.
With little needles.
Yep, yeah. And we were DJing live to hundreds of thousands of people.
Yeah, who were tuning in.
Who were tuning in, listening to what we were doing. But what
we did it like it was a proper Las Vegas. Do you remember? It was built.
Dave, that
were your team GB. Team Lee Butler, or you were team?
It was, and that's the one thing that stands out for me about the 051 was that
it was fun, wasn't
opening
it?
Opening night, people had banners with Team Dave Graham. Yeah. They had T-shirts with I Love Lee Butler. They brought them, but we didn't give them them.
No,
they brought them themselves.
They really were loyal supporters.
They were,
and it shows you as well, because at that particular time there was a lot of fun. In what we were doing, because I think the music industry was just so open at that time. It was just, no matter what was going on, fun was definitely part of what the 051 was for those 3 or 4
Dave,
years.
Dave, we put so much into the production, though. We wanted people to come to Club 051 and have an experience. Yeah. It wasn't just about us playing music. It was, we had fireworks going off. And do you remember the fireworks we used to have? They were set down and they've got to be illegal.
They are now.
Oh, mate, they were fired, like fireworks.
Over people's heads
on this like little piece of wire.
Yeah.
We had explosions on the stage when no one was doing that. We had, remember the entertainers? We used to have them statues, them white statues on the stage. We had teams of dancers. I mean,
we went over to, there was a place on the Wirral called Lancelin Lighting. It's probably still there, but they are theatrical people who do theatre productions. And I remember going in and saying to them, we're going to do this thing in this club, but we want it to be like Vegas kind of, not cheesy, but we want a show. We want to put something on where people will go, oh my God. But now you go into, if you go over to Ibiza and you look at these cannons.
Now you mention Ibiza. Now, we went over for my stag do, didn't we?
Oh.
We won't go into, we'll save that for another time.
I'm not sure remember, you can broadcast any of that.
Can you remember when we went to, what was the club we went to and they had the massive CO2 cannons in the middle of the club?
And John Kelly was playing, wasn't he? Do you remember?
Yeah, that was in El Paradis, wasn't it?
It was John Kelly was playing. We all got in. I remember dancing in a plant pot. Remember them big plant pots?
But we took a lot of inspiration from that, didn't we? Remember when we came back, we were like,
we need these
CO2 jets. Yeah. We need, I mean, now the standard at a big gig.
Correct.
But back in 96...
Pyrotechnics.
We come back from there... A couple of days early, might I add.
No one was doing that in Liverpool.
No, we wanted this.
That's where the money we went into.
We wanted this production.
Yeah, and that's important. Give me a track, Lee, that reminds you... I've got mine that I just think if there was a period that covered you and I, for me, I'd say it would be Sonic.
Okay.
And I'd say Sonic for two reasons. One, because I hated the fact that you got it off Les Calver first and I didn't. But more importantly, mate, it reminds me of a time when we used to go out finding records, where nowadays you can just go online, you can find something and you can be downloading it and you can have it within an instant.
As you said earlier,
every DJ can do that now.
The actual feeling when you got a track that you knew was huge
and you
knew
no
one else had it was amazing. There was Sonic, let me tell you what the story was behind Sonic. Sonic came out, the conductor and the cowboy mix. Now, there was Sonic's normal mix was about, it was bubbling away and was going to be a big hit, but this actual conductor and the cowboy remix that came out, I managed to press it on an acetate. Now, an acetate back then, can you remember, they were
a piece of glass.
They were slabs of metal.
Yeah.
That you would be, and you'd only get about 15 or 20 plays out of them. I got hundreds out of that.
Gone.
And you used to get, the only way of getting an acetate was to get it from the actual pressing plant. So these was the track that DJs would play to test out whether
if it
worked
would work before it
before
got signed.
They pressed it to a vinyl. So I had that track on acetate. So no one else had it. There was probably two or three of them in the world. So when I ask you what track reminds you of me from Club 051. It's got to be Sonny. Here it is. Sonny, conductor and the cowboy, and feels so good.
And that's what takes me higher than I've been before. Your love, it keeps me alive. Thought I should let you know that your touch it means so.
What the Butler Saw, the podcast with me, Lee Butler. It is, of course, available on my website. If you haven't checked out my new website yet, what's the matter with you? LeeButler.co.uk. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you'll get notifications there, and you're part of the gang and the podcast crew. Just get on board, get to iTunes and subscribe, or if you go to my website, leebutler.co.uk, everything you possibly need will be there. And you can write me a nice review as well. If you love listening to me chatting to the Mr. DJ, Mr. Dave Graham, then please do leave us a nice review as we continue. We've just heard Sonic and Feel So Good, a tune that I've asked Dave Graham to name me a track that reminds him of me from Club 051, and that is the tune he played, and he couldn't have picked a better one. Absolutely loved that tune. So I'm going to ask you the big question now, Dave. This is the question that so many people ask me, and I can remember this quite well. And I'll tell you why I can remember it well, is because I can remember feeling your pain that you went through to make this decision. You nearly made this decision before this, correct, and you changed your mind.
Correct.
And I think your gut wanted to go, but your heart wouldn't let you. And I remember seeing and feeling lots of the pain that you were going through to make this decision. It was so tough for you because you were leaving a massive part of your life behind. And of course, you'd left the Drome and come to the 051, but I don't think that had your heartstrings like this place did. And so I'm going to ask you the question that everywhere I go, someone says to me, and at the time, it was a huge talking point. And I don't think you've ever, ever give a proper explanation.
I've never spoke about it before.
So I'll ask you the question. Why did you leave the 051?
Let's go back to what you said before. What was it hard? It was hard because I knew.
Let me tell you how hard it was. Let me tell people who are listening to this podcast how hard it was for you. You sobbed.
Yeah.
Like a baby.
Yeah.
When on the day when you actually had that talk with the bosses.
Yeah. I remember getting into the lift.
You cried your eyes out.
Yeah. I remember walking into the lift and thinking, what have I done? But I knew I wasn't happy. I knew. And I knew it was going to be hard. And you're right, you covered it before because we'd had the chat. And it was actually 1990 that I wanted to leave. I sat down. I spoke to you first and said, I'm not happy here. I'm not feeling that. Musically, it was where I was at that time. I remember then sitting down with the bosses, and of course they didn't want to change anything, because you don't try and mend something that's not broke. There was queues around the block. It was lockdowns every week. We were selling CDs, tapes. It was a monster that had been created.
Musically, it had changed
massively.
Had done.
And I think what for me musically, it changed so much what I was playing. And I remember them saying, this is back in 1999, just give it another 6 months. And I said, I'll agree, but I don't want to play the main sets. Now, as you know, there's not many DJs who will say, I tell you what, I'll warm up. Because I remember having the conversation with you and you went, what? You're not going to play them? And I said, no, I'm done. I can't carry on. I felt like I was becoming a jukebox. I felt like I was playing music because it was feeding the fire.
And I can remember when, and this was all down to your passion for music, though. It was down to your passion for music.
A lot of people think we fell out, you know. A lot of people think that we, and that was never the case. But we've never had, to be honest, until today, we've never really had the opportunity to discuss it. But we never fell out. I'm godfather to your beautiful daughter.
Yep, you are.
We are dear friends.
Absolutely.
We've always had each other's back.
Yep.
We always believe in each other. And always. We've always pushed things across to each other. What do you think of this? I'm thinking about doing that. What do you think about this? And I think that, mate, is a great honour when I get them calls off you, and I hope it's the same in return.
Of course it is. And what's great about our friendship is the fact that we can be brutally honest with each other and not get offended.
Ever.
So, you know, that's a unique chat. And we took that into the clubs and into our promotion. We would bash ideas around, Dave, for the 051, and it'd be no issue just saying, that's pathetic.
That's not going to work.
What a load of that is. And then we'd move on to the next one. Unique ways, but
that's very hard. When I said to you, you said to me, you don't want to play 12 o'clock till 2 anymore with me. And I was like, I've got to find my music again, because I knew if I started playing the stuff that I really wanted to play at that time of night,
and you were starting to play that, and if we're brutally honest,
it wasn't working.
Wasn't not working, but
the
music had changed so much at the 051 as we headed into the 2000s that your music that you wanted to play,
it just wouldn't work at that time.
It was housier. Yeah. It was funkier.
Just wouldn't work. And
it
I remember
wasn't working
one night
at peak time,
playing Professional Widow, the Tori Amos.
Yeah.
And I knew that track was massive. and it fell. And it was one of the reasons I thought, if this is what I want to play, I need to find somewhere new to play. And it was that easy then. And it was an easy situation because musically, I felt that I used the word jukebox. But because I was part of a team and it was not all about the Dave Graham Roadshow, the 051, it was built around many, many factors. A lot of people always give me a great deal of credit, which is very nice, but there was a great deal of factors that went into that club, the security, how it was run, how it was promoted, the DJs, everything about it being on Radio City. I was a very small cog in a very big wheel.
Liverpool, we've just done the 051 reunion last weekend. It was amazing, wasn't it?
Phenomenal.
It was incredible. And I think that showed you the passion that Liverpool had. It was like, when we were competing at that point in 96, 7, 8, 9 with Cream bringing global DJs and not just one.
Yeah.
Like
three or four
in one night. Yet we were still putting 2,000 people in Club 051. And I think last Saturday at the reunion
showed
you how much love there is that these kids that when they were coming at 18, 19, 20 to Club 051 or 17, 18, 19 and nicking in and getting past the doorman, how much it meant to them.
Yeah.
And I know how much it meant to you, and that's why I know how tough it was for you to leave.
It was difficult sitting down and saying to them, guys, that's it.
That's what you found more difficult, wasn't it?
I knew for a while. I'd known for 12 months.
You had done, yeah.
I knew for 12 months that the music that I was playing was not the music I wanted to be playing. And I knew that I was part of an agreement that we had between us all. We were all partners. And if I dropped my part of the deal and the club fell, I'd feel really bad because I'd just left my three friends down. And that was the hard thing, saying that I can't carry on doing this. I've got to just go and find myself and just get away. And that's exactly what I did. I found a situation where I came to work. I wasn't coming to work to say I'm going to leave. I just remember getting in the lift. Instead of turning right to go into my office, I just turned left and went into theirs. And they were like, "You okay?" And I was like, need to sit down, need to chat.
I never forget how upset you were that day.
It was
horrendous. You absolutely sobbed above, in the lift.
I didn't want the lift to move because I knew when I got to the bottom of the floor, there'd be more people there looking at me going, "What's up? What's going on?"
Yeah.
Such a big part of 9 years. Yeah. Is a big part of your life, Lee, when you've shared 9 years with, I call them partners, but they were all friends. You know, we'd all gone through. I'd lost my mum at that particular time. We'd all shared personal loss, great triumphs in those 9 years. There was brilliant highs and there was tremendous lows, and everyone was there for you. So to walk away and say, "This is not for me," it was a big call. A really big call for me.
It was very, very tough for you indeed. It was tough for us as well. So there you have it. That's the reason why Dave Graham left Club 051. And on that note, we'll tie it up with the 051 with me asking you another question. So come on.
A track.
Early on, I asked you to play me a track that stunk of Club 051 in 94, 95. You chose Judy Cheeks and Reach. What an amazing song that is. Huge song. We played that in the States at that point as well. Brilliant track. So we're coming back to the point where you left Club 051 and the music had changed. Can you play me something from your last days at Club 051 and sort of that musical shift that you think? What would you play?
This is when I was warming up, and probably the last track in my set warming up for you coming on. It would be something like Kings of Tomorrow, Finally. And you can now understand musically that's where I was at that time compared to where I was at the very beginning of the journey.
Well, the 051 at that point had become faster, harder. The Scouse House scene had kicked off in Liverpool. Everything was going to 140 BPM. You were probably playing at 125, 26.
I was so far behind it.
So your stuff at that point, if you were coming on at 1 o'clock in the morning, musically and speed-wise, it wouldn't work.
No.
So while we were booking all the Cisco Kids and Ian Van Daals and Ultra Beats and all these people, that's the point where I think you thought...
I was the round peg in the square.
Yeah, and that's when you moved on and did something else. So Dave Graham is picking a tune from the very end. And what an amazing song, Dave.
And ironically, man, the name of it, Kings of Tomorrow, and Finally.
Finally, which is your final track in Club 051.
Correct.
And it's still a massive tune in Liverpool. Here it is.
So tell me, how do you do? Finally, I meet you. You don't know what... So tell me, how do you do?
But The Butler Saw, the podcast with me, Lee Butler, it is available on iTunes. You can subscribe and you will get all the info in the place with the bass before anybody else. Get on there and subscribe on iTunes. What The Butler Saw, Lee Butler, the podcast. I'm joined for my first one by Mr. Dave Graham. We have just heard the incredible Kings of Tomorrow and finally summing up his final years at Club 051. And so we've made that big decision to leave Club 051. Dave, you finally told the bosses, you'd sobbed, you'd got upset about it, we'd hugged, we'd squeezed, and I'd felt your bum. But you then went on to sort of showcase that style musically, which is the reason you left 051. Yeah. And the reason it was difficult was more emotional, more than yeah. anything else. Musically, you felt like you wanted to move on to a fresh challenge, which you did do. And you then
went to St. George's Hall. Remember, yeah, we booked St. George's. I remember about 2 weeks after leaving, sitting in the house and thinking, I just need to find something to get my energy into. So I went, I just walked across. And I walked inside and I went to speak to the security manager and he brought me into the offices. I remember sitting down with the guy and I said, this is an amazing space. I'd love to put a party on in here. And he said, what do you mean a party? And I said,
did you avoid the word rave?
Oh, God, nowhere near.
Even nowadays, when I'm looking for unique venues or anything, and I speak to like a farmer in a farmer's yeah. field who's got an old barn that I'm thinking, oh, that'd be good in there. Do not use the word rave.
Correct.
They just go, rave!
Well, he looked
drugs!
At me. He said,
rave what? Means drugs!
Exactly. He looked at me and he said, do you know this Minton floor is one of the greatest historical finds and
tough
neoclassical buildings?
It was very tough to get St. George's all to agree.
And I said,
very tough.
We're going to do the donations to Marie Curie. I'm going to invite a load of my friends. And he goes, we talking 100? And I said, no, I've got about 1,000. And he went, oh, what do you do? Are you a footballer? And I thought, I better not tell him my name in case he, you know, finds out what I do. And then he just scuppers the whole idea. But we did. We put on my first event to showcase that kind of music at St. George's Hall. It got sponsored by BMW from Williams down the road. And it was just a game changer because I knew that.
But you always set your standards high, Dave. That's one thing I've took a lot from. And I say that as a compliment. You know, if you're going to do something, you do it properly. You know, and that's the point. That's the point in my life that I'm at now is like with Reminisce as well. We just won't cut corners.
No. The reason and Reminisce, you can see that, can't
the, you? The reason Reminisce has become so successful within our seventh year next year, we've gone from 2,000 to 17,000 people.
Wow.
And that only happens by putting your heart and soul and your passion and not cutting corners.
Correct.
And more importantly, having a team of people. It's teamwork. It's teamwork. And, you know, I learned a lot of that from you is that if you're going to do it,
No one wants to come second in life.
Do it properly.
Yeah.
Even if it takes you longer and it costs you more.
People vote with the feet, Lee, don't they? Year on year, I can see what you've done there. Year on year, it is building. And that tells you because people are voting with the feet. And when I left the 051, I took off for 6 months because I just literally thought, I need to find myself. I went round Europe so much. I went over to America, met friends that I'd made. And I wanted to just see, had I gone off on this tangent of music that I really believed in and I was on my own? Because sometimes, mate, you can get carried away and you think this is the greatest thing and then you get sort of sit there and there's no one around you and you go, oh, maybe I was wrong.
No,
so
listen,
I wanted to find
listen,
out
and we've
if
all
I was
had
right.
Made some huge mistakes in my career. Loads of them where I've thought this, I've tried to put nights on that haven't worked. I've thought I'll do this, I'll do that. I've bought a bar that didn't work. You learn by your errors, don't you? And as long as you do that, it's important. But when you left the 051 and you went and done your own thing, it led on, obviously, George's Hall was amazing. And I can remember that because it was standout. It was class. It was quality.
It was
different,
wasn't it, for what was happening?
It was upmarket, which is everything you're about. Yeah. It's quality. Then we head on to Society.
Yeah. Well, Society came about really because when I'd left the 051, I was like Stelios's best customer for 6 months because I just every week I could go to Italy for £18 or I could go to Milan for £22 and I could go over to Parma for £6. So I thought, do you know what? I've got nothing to do. So me and my beautiful wife would just jump on a flight and just disappear and just wander around. And then you get to meet people there and they would say, oh, you want to go to this night? And they play this kind of music or this DJ's on. And I found myself going to clubs, keeping in mind that the 051 would hold 2,500-3,000 people. I was going to clubs that held 400 or 500 people and found the atmosphere electric and playing the kind of music that I wanted to play. So when I came back, there was two or three offers on the table for me to go and join other clubs, which I'm not going to talk about, the best offer that fitted what I wanted to do was from Society, because I never forget sitting down and saying, they literally just said, what do you want to do? What kind of music do you want to bring? Because Society was already open. It was already up and running. And I thought it was the perfect club because it was smaller, but it had this kind of New York loft feeling about it, with the balcony where you could look over and the dance floor. It was a little bit different. It was smaller, and it just had a great ambience about it for me. And I remember them saying, what kind of music do you want to play? Because we couldn't play the music was where I've just left, because that, again, is just copying what we've already done, and that's not progression, is it? I wanted to put together the DJs, the entertainment side of things, and just do something at that time that wasn't being done. I remember the Joe saying to me, who are the DJs? And I thought, I've got to get Les Calvert.
Yeah, because... amazing DJ.
A DJ for Liverpool who's worked in all the big record shop, worked for me for ages, worked for 3Beat for ages, and to me, probably one of the most underrated DJs. And I don't know why.
Not underrated by the DJs.
Correct.
But maybe, you know, if you say underrated, maybe you mean... not as many people give him the credit he deserves.
Audience-wise. I think he was just...
incredible mind and his mind of knowledge. Music. His knowledge of music, Les Calvert, is phenomenal. And that lad can play anything.
Correct.
You give him a disco set, he'll nail it. You give him an 80s set, he'll nail it. Ask him to do a 60s set, he'll nail it for you. He's phenomenal.
He was first on the list. He had to be the DJ for me that we had, because I knew that anchor, we could do anything in that club with him. And when I say underrated, I mean, when you think of his credibility amongst the people who play in Liverpool, you think he would have had nights of his own. He just didn't push himself. He just didn't go out there and do it. He just wanted to be passionate to the music. We were a bit more business savvy with regard to that.
Yeah, you're probably right. You're probably right, yeah.
So he was the first to get on board. And then some little guy called Dave Whelan. Not many people know him. You may know him as Camel Fat.
What a success story.
Mate.
And you know what?
The three of us, that was it. The rest is literally history there, because what we did in there for a very short space of time before it moved and went across to its new
venue.
So we're
now talking about Society in Fleet Street,
yeah,
aren't we? Yeah, so we're talking about Fleet Street now. And I think that was probably what all the Society crowd hold the best memories, isn't it, Fleet Street?
I think so, because, again, it was a little bit organic, it was a little bit new, and it was, again, something that no one else was doing. And the production team, the guys in there, Gary, who was head of the entertainment, was phenomenal. Really, 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 I have a lot of respect for him, of what he built in there. He was extremely talented. Musically, no one was going to tell Dave, Les or me what to play.
You had musical freedom, didn't you?
I had the musical
freedom.
And
that's why you left.
Is the one thing.
That's what you wanted, isn't it?
I just didn't have that passion. And if you're just playing music because you know it's going to make you money, then you just go into work. That's a jukebox. I'm not a jukebox. I'd like to entertain. I'd like to bring something to the table that no one else has got. Society was a great thing for me. And we built something there very, very quickly. Again, an amazing team of people around us brought that on the map.
And what a successful story Dave Whelan is. Dave Whelan and Mike DeScala. Now, Mike DeScala's, for me, I mean, we had BCD records when all the Scouse House was in, and we were playing all the BCD stuff. And I used to sit in Mike DeScala's bedroom in his mum's house in the Brookside estate and make tunes on the first PC he ever had, me and Mike, and Les. Yeah. So BCD was Butler, Calvert, DeScala.
Wow.
And that was what that was. And all our BCD tunes came out. And Mike, you knew back then, was just an absolute star in the making. Yeah. And look how hard he worked. He's been
there.
A massive hardcore DJ as Recon. He's been the front man of Ultrabeat.
Yeah.
He's had an album out with Ultrabeat. His Whelan and DeScala music was amazing, wasn't it?
Phenomenal.
And finally broke for the pair of them as Camel Fat. And you know what? I couldn't be more thrilled for the pair of them. And they both kept their feet on the ground as well.
We went to see them in Ibiza in August. And, you know, I had a tear in my eye watching them, because, you know what? They're just the same
they
lads.
They deserve every
they're
single
just the
thing
same
they
lads.
Get.
And
just
that's got to
so
be the greatest thing to have that credibility and that following that they've got, and they are without doubt. I mean, you've also, don't forget, we've got another big DJ in Liverpool. Don't forget Yusef.
Of course, Yusef. Huge DJ. Huge.
Liverpool has been a great place for musical talent that's now exposed.
If we're
all
talking
over the world.
Of the hottest DJs at the minute, though, them boys are absolutely on. Bommy. They are on fire, Camel Fat.
They should really have some fire extinguishers next to themselves.
They should have. I'm sure Dave has a couple on
fire.
Of them.
They were great. They were really good.
So we're talking about society. I want to ask you now to play me a track or an anthem that you think sums up society.
Oh, the remix of the Leo and Bushwhacker, Man with the Red Face. That was just like a moment when that got played that, it was like whoever dropped it, and all three of us would play that track. In them days, it was not about Les would do this bit, Dave would do that bit, and I'd do that bit. We all had political freedom to play what we wanted. That was the one track we all wanted to play, because when it played, something happened in that club. You could put 1,000 people in that room who didn't know each other, and when that broke down, that sax kicks in, you've got 1,000 people looking at each other going, are we really witnessing this? Have a listen to this
tune.
It's my man, Lee Butler.
Walk About the Song with Lee Butler. The podcast.
Allow me to show you something.
Music, clubland stories and more.
You know it makes sense.
What the Butler Saw, the podcast, now up and running and in full effect. Catch me just gabbing and getting all the gossip, the scandal, the clubland jangle with loads of different people and asking them to spin me some music as well. Super cool. You subscribe to it on iTunes. It is all available via my website, leebutler.co.uk. You can even leave me a nice review on iTunes as well. Today is all about Dave Graham, and we've chatted about so much so far, Dave, haven't we?
It's been good, hasn't it?
It's been very good indeed. We could go on for hours and hours and hours and hours, myself and Dave Graham. But obviously, we've covered the drone. We've covered Club 051. We've found out why you left. We've touched on society. Garlands as well. We've got to give Garlands a mention, mate.
I mean, Garlands is great, wasn't it? Friday night.
Do you remember the Fridays we had called Peach?
Oh, yeah. Peach. That was even before.
Then we had Sex at Garlands.
Wow.
That was like a tougher Friday night, wasn't it? With some amazing production and some amazing dancers. And
Friday night, no one doing anything really in Liverpool on a Friday. Shows you the following we had in them days. That people would come out. And you put something good together.
And we did. Little John used to play there with us on a Friday night as well.
About that.
Another fantastic DJ, Little John.
Super brilliant. He played brilliantly on Saturday, didn't he?
He did. He was amazing.
Would you say thank you to everyone who came on Saturday to the
Camp of Fairness?
What an amazing and emotional journey that was from the music from the minute. I mean, it was funny because my first set was 7:30 and no word of a lie, at 10 past 7, I was in John Lewis's buying a Hoover. And then 20 minutes later, the driver got me to the door and I went straight on. And I remember shaking my head thinking, how mad is my world? I was looking at Dyson's, other Hoovers are available. And I remember thinking to myself, this is mad, isn't it? I don't do this anymore. I choose nice little things to do that I think that'll be good, something for the kids to look back on and, say, Dad, you're making a show of yourself. I like that. I like embarrassing the kids. Well, how mad.
Listen, there's nothing worse for your kids than seeing a bit of dad dancing, is there? Oh, I remember it when I was a kid.
Snake,
I mean, mum and dad would start dancing and going, Stop it! Hiding behind the curtains. What's the matter with you? So, listen, that leads me onto, you've come back, you're now spinning tunes. You don't do it very often.
I've chose a few parties next year. I've got something really special happening with a brand called Church, which I'm really excited about because the lads who are involved in that, Mike and Dave, they've came down and said, look, we want to do something different again. Do you want to be part of it? And musically, I know they are definitely part of the same tapestry of where I've come from. So that's going to be exciting. So if anyone's out on Boxing Night, that's going to be Alma de Cuba. And it's going to be a show. It's going to be special. And it's going to be very, very different.
Alma de Cuba is a gorgeous venue as well. There's
brilliant.
Two reasons to go. Alma de Cuba Box Night with Dave Graham. New Year's Eve, I will be at Alma de Cuba bringing in New Year with Big Ange performing It's Over Now.
It's a great
You've
place,
been
isn't
cheating
it?
And telling me lies. She's going to be live New Year's Eve. So Box Night, New Year's Eve. Dave Graham there, Boxing Night, and New Year's Eve, I'll be there with Radio City as well. So you missed DJing. You were out for a while, weren't you? You're a happily married man. You've got two gorgeous kids.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've settled down and, you know, you obviously you've got your own company and your own businesses and you're abroad quite a lot as well.
But I do miss it, Lee. I do miss all the things that I've been blessed to be a part of. And that's important because the opportunities that I've had over 30 years are really, really important. The people that I've met, the places that I've been are all part of that big tapestry of 30 years in this industry. And I miss the energy as well because, and I still think that energy is there. You know, you look at the guys who are doing Kingdom and Mansion, they've got queues round the block all the time. So the energy is still there, but if you're not in the scene, you're not part of it. And it would be wrong to say I don't miss it. I miss that magic, really. The biggest thing for me is that magic when you can drop a track that no one's ever heard before and 2,000 people just lose the plot. That's magic. That's something that you can't bottle.
When someone asks me about, you know, obviously I'm, you know, I've been here for years now. I'm still hugely passionate. I'm doing loads of big events, and you always say to me when we talk, "I don't know how you do it, Lee. You're so passionate about what you're doing," and you know, it's what I do. You know, I'm lucky in a sense that my job happens to be something I absolutely love doing.
So you'd never go to do a day's work in your life, do you?
It's tough. Exactly. It's stressful at times, of course it is, and you know, there's big risks in some of the stuff, but. Yeah. You know, I love what I do, and Reminisce was my baby, and it's grown and grown, and all the amazing things we do. But we were very blessed, Dave. Let's get it right. We were very blessed to have been part of the scene when it was at its best.
Correct. Yeah.
Liverpool was spoilt, whether it was the Underground or it was the Quadrant Park or the State or the Buzz or the Cream or the Paradox or Fallows or these little unique nights that were going on. G-Love at the Mardi Gras with John Kelly. There were so many.
Circus. There's tons of them.
And, you know, we were so spoiled. Yeah. You could go out on a Saturday night and choose.
Spoiled is the right word.
I'm not saying it's not brilliant for the youngsters now. Of course it is. These youngsters are still going having amazing experiences at some of these amazing nights and going to massive festivals.
Travelling abroad as well. Course, you look at the breakout festival.
Yeah, they're all having amazing nights. Yeah. Of course they are. But when I say that, and I don't mean that to say it was better then than it is now, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is we were spoiled for choice.
Yeah.
You could go out on a Saturday night and you could go to a proper club and you could have picked one of many.
Yeah.
You can't now.
No, there's not a lot.
We haven't got any clubs left, really. Proper big clubs, weekly clubs. We were spoilt for choice back then. We were spoilt for choice. So look, current house music. I know you're still passionate about your current house music, aren't you? You're still, you know, you're always pecking my head with new tunes. You're sending me stuff. This guy, listen, let me tell you. You think Dave Graham and people, this lad never stops listening to new music. I'll get a WhatsApp and go, "You've got to listen to this, listen to this." He'd be recording something on his computer screen. "Listen to this, kick in, Lee." Boo, boo.
Oh. I remember saying to you, do you remember that track that came out? It must be about 3 or 4 months old now. Joy's If I Had a Choice.
Yeah.
It was done by, we had it at the 051 by Silverstone. And I remember saying to you, "Lee, it's not enough to hear the music. You've got to feel it. It's no good playing it down the phone to you. Go, get this on. Put your headphones on. Close your eyes and listen to this." That is the kind of music that I play now. That is the kind of music you're going to hear more of if you come to the events that I'm involved in. So I'm going to say thanks to everyone. And thanks to you, Lee, as well, mate, because it's been an amazing opportunity to go back and clear as well a lot of air that people would have thought, "I didn't think they got on. We're thicker than thieves, me and you." And now it's probably time for all of that bad rumour to go to rest. But it's been great, mate, going backwards. And I wish you all the success in these podcasts. And I hope they're as exciting and as entertainment and probably in some areas when I rabbit on as boring. But it's nice, mate, to say all the things that we've said and give the people who are the most important people in our world, mate, the people who've supported us for all the years.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And it's nice to be able to say, this is what we're really like. We're just two normal lads from Liverpool who've been really blessed to have the opportunities put in front of them that we've had.
Absolutely. And you know what, Dave? We're going to finish the podcast off like we were doing a club night. So me and you have done this podcast and we've built it from the start. We've been through from the pen and wig when you DJed. I chatted to you about when you were trying to find the money to buy your first set of decks. We've told the whole story of Dave Graham. We've built you through from the drone. We've took you from the drone and we've put you into Club 051. And we've talked about when we first joined forces and the amazing night of Battle of the Heavyweights. I've took you about the pain that you felt when you left Club 051, about the new chapter of society. We've played your favourite society track. we've now got to the end of the podcast and we've treated this like a club night and you've got thousands of people there just waiting for your final track. What's your last track of the podcast, Steve? Finish us with a big tune of yours.
That is a really hard question. But if I thought at any point, in any event, anywhere in the world, I could play this track and it would just explode, be Josh Wink, Higher State of Consciousness.
Absolute tune. Dave Graham, if you love what we've spoken about tonight, myself and Dave Graham on the What the Butler Saw podcast, it is, of course, on iTunes. Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you get to my new website, leebutler.co.uk. There's loads on there. There's blogs that I'm writing about, stuff that tickles me, some good club stuff, some memories on there as well. As well as that, you can get all my up-and-coming gigs. There's ticket links to my gigs. Everything's on my website, including the podcast. But we've been catching up today with Dave Graham. It's been an amazing. We could have chatted for hours, Dave, couldn't we?
Easy.
Hours and hours on end. I'm looking how long we've been talking.
The producers are looking at us going,
Get out the studio. But it's been an absolute privilege to catch up with you, Dave. And
you're a star. Love you, brother.
It is Dave Graham's final tune. We finish the podcast with Josh Wink and Higher State of Consciousness, but not before. If you love what Dave Graham's about, and I'm going to ask you now, Dave, for one final thing. All the people who are listening to the podcast will go, we want to hear some music from Dave Graham. If I ask you to do me a 20-25 minute mix,
yeah, cool,
and just full of some of your favorite memories, would you do that?
Brilliant. We'll bang an hour out and put 3 20s out.
There you go. I'm going to get you an hour of Dave Graham, an hour worth of Dave Graham's most spine tingling emotional memories on one mix. Will be on my website. Keep checking it, leebutler.co.uk. go to the music section and we will find Dave Graham in the mix for one solid hour. Dave, thank you very much.
It's been an honor.
Thank you.
The Butler Saw with Lee Butler. The podcast. Subscribe now. Visit leebutler.co.uk.